Welcome back to the weekly roundup with Dira De Boer and William McGimpsey for RCR Plus, where we take a look back at the key events from the previous week. And thank you to all of the listeners and watchers who enjoyed last week's show so much that you sent feedback. So Jackie said she really appreciated the perspective on culture wars and immigration that you brought up at the end of that show. And Joanne also said something similar that, she thought it was an excellent summary of the hot topics. And we had some good feedback from Mike as well, who said that he was really really enjoying the weekly roundup. So thank you to those of you who sent feedback. And if you have particular issues you'd like us to cover, please send those in as well. Welcome back to the show, William.
Yeah, thanks, Dewa. And thanks to the people who sent the feedback in. It's really nice to hear that you're enjoying the show and getting something out of it. I thought, yeah, it was an interesting conversation last time. We sort of linked together culture war issues and immigration. And I thought, yeah, it turned out quite well that show. We sort of brought a bunch of sort of things together and gave a sort of overall view of it.
Now, there's been a bit of a trend in some liberal commentators who are sort of right-leaning, I guess, who have in the free speech space, who have been very critical of some of the points that you and I would make. We're calling it woke right, saying if you're making these connections between immigration and the culture wars, then that's the same as wokeness, but just on the right wing. And the Free Speech Union is actually doing a tour this year, and they've got James Lindsay, who is the man who basically invented this, I guess, insult of woke right, who's coming to tour in New Zealand. And I think just to pick up this conversation, do you believe that's a, I guess, a helpful development in the free speech space to have these people who are broadening the scope of what wokeness is?
No, not really. For a long time, people on the right have had to labor under a system where our ideas have been called racist and sexist and homophobic and sometimes anti-Semitic or xenophobic. There's a whole bunch of terms. And the way these terms are used, they're used to demonize and stigmatize views. They're even There's movements to get these terms put into law in the form of hate speech laws. And that's going on. And there's a push for that in New Zealand. There's pushes for that in other countries. They're putting anti-Semitism laws in Australia at the moment. But even when these things aren't put in as laws, there's a sort of soft power ecosystem on the left that when they find a target, they label it. They bring it to the public's attention, the person saying the things that they don't like. And then sometimes they go after them personally and they try and get them fired from their jobs. They try and make them unemployable, make them a persona non grata. And they do lots of other horrible things to them as well to try and target them and bring personal costs to bear on them because those people are saying things that they don't like. That's the way these terms are used. But the positive development in recent times has been that people have sort of clicked onto this. And the Free Speech Union, to their credit, have been one of these groups that have clicked onto this and done a lot of good stuff about it. And I know because I worked in there and I helped them do a lot of this stuff. That they've clicked onto this cancel culture, this censorship, and they've realized that at a sort of systemic level, it's preventing discussion of a whole bunch of stuff right throughout our academia, the public sector, the media, and everything else. And so there's a big effort on now, not just in New Zealand, but in the US and in many other countries to try and take down this sort of soft power censorship system so people can really discuss these ideas. But James Lindsay is sort of trying to resurrect that soft power censorship system with a new term, woke right. And it has the same sort of function. It's trying to brand a whole a set of ideas with this term and then make them off limits. And what he's trying to do is disingenuous. It's disingenuous. So wokeness isn't a term that the right applied to the left in order to slander and demonize like all these other terms. It's a term the left applied to themselves. It's what people working in the civil rights movements called themselves woke to racial injustice. Barack Obama popularized the term. And people on the right started taking it from there, because that's what the left-wing people who believed in these things believed in, sort of what we've called gay race communism, which is, you know,
Radical leftism, right? If you want a very
yeah.
simple definition of wokeness, it's radical leftism.
So what they're doing is they're trying to, their plan, their agenda is to sort of equalize socioeconomic outcomes across all these racial and ethnic and sexual classes of people. And that's what wokeness is. So to try and apply, and this ideology has grown to be extremely damaging to Western civilization. It's frankly, it's anti-Western, anti-white, anti-Christian in character. And what the game that's being played here is to conflate the woke left with the woke right, and say both of these groups are doing identity politics, right? And identity politics is the great evil thing. So the people on the left are doing sort of anti-white, anti-Western, anti-Christian identity politics, and the people on the right are doing pro-white, pro-Western, pro-Christian identity politics. They're sticking up for their own people and culture. And the sensible centrist that James Lindsay is trying to style himself as, he's trying to say, well, these two groups, they're both doing the same sort of thing. They're both doing identity politics, and that's bad. But the reason this analysis is wrong, it's a bit like if a doctor said, well, you know, your immune system and your cancerous tumor are fighting with each other, and they're both equally bad, so we need to sort of disable and suppress both of them. That wouldn't really be the correct diagnosis for a cancer patient, would it? So that's one way of thinking about this. But another way is James Lindsay's analysis is based on equating the postmodernism in the left, because they're postmodern, and saying there's a postmodern right now. And there is such a thing as a postmodern right, but it's the people he's applying the label postmodern right to are Christians and traditionalists and these sorts of people who aren't postmodern at all.
People engaging in classical political theory,
They're
basically,
pre-modern,
on
if
the woke right.
anything. So his analysis is incorrect, and it's also disingenuous, because he's trying to say two things that aren't alike are alike. He's just trying to leverage the negative associations that have built up around the word woke in order to discredit people on the right.
Well, thank you very much for that summary and follow-up. And hopefully we'll see if the Free Speech Union and James Lindsay engage with this more, because of course more free speech is good and we want more free speech.
Well, that's the other thing I'd just like to add before we move on. Like, I don't actually think it's a bad thing that he's coming here and talking about this, because he's been talking about this on the online for a while now. And the conversation, in my reading of it, hasn't actually gone his way. Like, he is losing the online debate, and because people can see through it for the reasons that I've explained here, and reasons many other people have explained online as well. And so I think it's good to bring him here and good to analyze his ideas. And I think I'm pretty confident that his ideas will lose, because they're not correct and they are disingenuous.
Are you sure that we don't want to cancel him? You know, we could get a protest his visa, I'm sure.
No, not at all. And bring him on. Let's debate his views, and let's show why they're incorrect.
I was joking about canceling the visa there, just in case any listeners missed the sarcasm. So we are going to cover geopolitics as well now. There have been quite a few developments in our own region as far as geopolitics goes in the last week. There have been some big escalations in our relationship with China and with the Cook Islands and between the Cook Islands and China. It was a situation where Chinese warships were engaging in live fire exercises in the Tasman Sea between Australia and New Zealand, which resulted in several commercial flights being redirected away from that area. And of course, this is a diplomatic incident. The Cook Islands as well has gone and signed a bunch of deals with China behind our backs. The Cook Islands Prime Minister had to survive a vote of no confidence from the opposition for this, because obviously very antagonistic towards New Zealand. And Winston Peters has also gone to China. I think the details of what's going on there are not yet available to us, but it is an increasingly tense diplomatic situation here in the South Pacific.
Yes, the alliances and the dividing lines between the groups are becoming crunchier and more defined, and countries like New Zealand are finding themselves increasingly being pushed into taking a side. For a long time now, we've touted this idea that we have an independent foreign policy and we're not in the back pocket of either the US or China or anyone else. But what we're seeing now is geopolitical competition hotting up. And it's going to be increasingly difficult for us to maintain that position. If we are going to maintain it, it's going to require quite a lot of skill
Yeah,
because.
AUKUS Pillar 2 was something that we discussed last year. There have been negotiations on that, and the pros and cons, of course, are difficult in some way to determine. But it seems very much like China views us as part of the American sphere, and so it's a little bit strange for us not to view ourselves as that, as part of the American sphere, as part of as being close to Australia. It seems inevitable that we will be, on that side of the diplomatic hostilities. There may never be a war, but certainly the sort of the Cold War that is shaping up, the trade wars, the tariff wars. We're not going to escape those at all.
Yeah, I think that's right. And so, what these great powers are doing is they're playing in this gray zone that exists between what you're allowed to do under international law, but what is viewed as sort of inappropriate or kind of aggressive anyway. So, there's a gray zone there. And issues like the Cook Islands, for example, and the South China Sea. And live fire exercises without notification in the Tasman Sea are examples of this. They're doing things that, under international law, you're allowed to do. But if you do do them, it sort of feels like you're stepping on toes a little bit. And this is sort of like boxers at the start of a match, sort of dancing around, feeling out the other person, testing how they respond, testing your resolve to defend yourself. So the Cook Islands is quite important. So the Cook Islands. Is it's not quite an independent country. It has a deal with New Zealand where we help them out with foreign policy and security and disaster relief. And in response, they have to consult with us on foreign policy and stuff like that. And they didn't consult with us on the deal they did with China before they did it. And China's trying to exploit this idea of self-determination for the Cooks, which is an idea that I believe in normally. But in this case, there's an agreement that the Cooks have signed that they have to live up to that I don't think they have in this situation. So you can see China's playing there. They're trying to bring the Cook Islands into their sphere of influence and into their sphere of power and pull them away from New Zealand. And they're doing this in many other Pacific Island countries as well, they're doing a lot of investment, getting these countries on side in that way, and also building ports and other infrastructure that they can use to refuel their boats and military stuff. For hundreds of years or 1,000 or more years, this has been how China has worked with its surrounding countries. It's attempted to use its power to sort of buy them off, absorb them, and turn them into tributaries, right? Basically, states that are within their sphere of influence that pay their money to China and China protects them, kind of like, protection racket, like a gang would do. And that's how it's run its foreign policy. And I think the Belt and Road Initiative, a lot of people tend to view the Belt and Road Initiative as purely about trade and investment as a sort of lever of economic policy. But I think for China, economic policy, geopolitics, security, and military, they're all sort of run together. And they use their economic policy to gradually make people more economically reliant on them so that they fall into their sphere of influence and away from other countries. That's the strategy in the Pacific. And New Zealand the Pacific is kind of our backyard. We're going to have to be on our toes diplomatically and do a lot of stuff to make sure that we keep those countries on side and prevent them going over to China.
I haven't got the chart here to put up on the screen, but what you've said made me think of this chart, and it had to do with, who the number one trading partner is of every country in the world. And going back a generation, 30 years, the map was painted blue. Basically, America was the number one trading partner of most of the countries in the world. And you fast forward to today, and China is the number one trading partner of New Zealand, Australia, every country in Africa. Almost every country in South America. It's the number one trading partner of Canada, even basically half of the European countries, of Russia. And so that really goes to show the big shift that has taken place trade-wise. And as you say, they attempt to, the Chinese will leverage this as best as they can. And we are caught up, we're definitely a part of this. And that's where our foreign policy at the end of the day is going to have to reflect a stance that divests itself more so from China and perhaps also from America in terms of the tariffs they tried to put on us. America has never really been the ideal trading partner, which has really helped China take over. But as we see now, China is also not the ideal trading partner. So there needs to be some real strategic thinking, long-term strategic thinking from the government and from the next government, to make sure that we have a long-term plan to for essentially trade stability, like New Zealand had for most of its history. We were the number one trading partner of the United Kingdom until they betrayed us for the European Common Market, but something like that was incredibly beneficial to New Zealand, and New Zealand has never truly recovered from that. And so finding a reliable trading partner that's not going to stab us in the back in the next 100 years would be in our best economic and geopolitical interest.
Well, I think this government, to give credit where credit is due, have done a lot of good work in the trade area. We've signed new trade deals with Saudi Arabia and the UAE, the Gulf states. Have we signed one with India? We may have signed one with India, or at least we're working on it. I'm not sure about
I
that.
believe it's being worked on, but this week, Vietnam was the big
Vietnam
one.
as well, and there's yeah, this I'm probably missing some other ones as now, but there has been a real effort, I think, to try and de-risk our trade situation because China is our biggest trading partner. I think the US is our second biggest.
Correct.
And if we can de-risk that by having a bunch of other markets, we become less dependent on these, on the sort of the financial power and the financial strings that these big powers can pull to bring us into line if that's what they want to do, because that's the real danger.
And speaking of countries being brought into line, there are two very small updates on elections in Europe. There were the German elections, in which the CDU, the Christian Democratic Union, won, and the AfD, the Alternative for Deutschland, came second place. And this was sort of as predicted, I think. There was a collapse of the traditional left-wing vote. But there was a bit of a resurgence of their so-called far left parties or more radical left parties, and a split among young people and old people. So, for instance, the older people voted more so for the traditional conservative party. I say traditional, but I mean the in the sense the well-established conservative party. The young people, however, split very much in favor of the newer parties. Young men broke for the AfD as the largest party, 25% of young men. And then I think 20, oh, it was 30, it was just over 30% of young women voted for the left party, the more a radical party appealing to young women. And then on the immigration side as well, there were some interesting statistics from Germany on how the immigrants, in particular Muslims, voted as well for these more radical left parties, which seems like a strange mix that you have these young progressive women and at the same time Muslim immigrants voting for these new left-wing parties.
Yeah, slightly worrying signs there in terms of the women, but some better signs in terms of the men. maybe that's the male perspective, probably is. But another important distinction is the what's going on in East Germany versus West Germany. So East Germany, I think the AfD won in every East German state, whereas the Conservatives were better in most, if not all, of the West German
Yeah,
ones. And
basically, there were a few city centres that were more for the socialists and the left, but it was essentially an east-west split in terms of who was the largest party, the AfD in the east and the CDU in the west.
so there's something about the influence of having lived under communist tyranny that is doing something to make those people more aware of the threat that immigration and some of these other issues are creating for the country. Whereas the people who've been living in Western Germany, they've, I don't know, I mean, they're more complacent. Perhaps they've been exposed to more more US influence, more US television. They haven't gone through the traumatic experience of living under tyranny, so they're less sensitized and less agitated to do something about it. There's also this sort of on the age thing, there's this strong pull in the boomers, if we can call them that, to really be against anything that's deemed far right. There's a real aversion. And I just feel like the boomers have gone through, I mean, the boomers went through the Beatles, they went through, you know, John Lennon, they went through all the stuff that it's the post-war era. There was a negative reaction toward war. There was this idea that we all need to come together. And sex, drugs, and rock and roll, and that this is the sort of boomer mentality. It's because of globalism, and they're just very reluctant to let go of that, even if they can sort of, even if there are a lot of threats coming from immigration and things like this, they're just very reluctant to let go of the sort of globalist worldview. But you can see that that sort of that same psychological conditioning doesn't seem to apply as strongly to the younger generations who are, in my opinion, seeing these threats more clearly and responding more rationally to them.
And I think looking at election statistics, the German election here has been the first time I've seen such a big split of older voters versus younger voters. Because often, at least for the last decades, the trend has sort of been, well, older voters are more right wing, younger voters are more left wing. But it really has shifted in the sense that now older voters are more for the liberal establishment, the status quo, defending the liberal order that they built. And then younger voters are more breaking, as we said, both ways in terms of what's going to replace the liberal order. And that seems to be up for grabs in terms of whether it's going to be a new left or a new right. On the whole, that seems to be a trend that's being repeated in European elections in particular.
Well, young people go to school. They're in the education system, and the education system in many Western countries resembles a brainwashing system. But that's been the same now for like you know, half a century or so. But the new thing is the mass media also used to be a kind of you know, left-wing brainwashing system, to put it bluntly. But now
I
we
think
have.
it's a fair way to say that sort of the television was the way to brainwash people, but now
Now we have social
television
media, right? So
is gone. Yeah.
there's a way of getting the truth into young people's minds. And as the young people are the ones who are more social media savvy, they're the ones who are more exposed to these different points of view. So and that what that shows is if you're exposed to different points of view, the ability of, you know, psychological conditioning, brainwashing, you know, like the inculcation that occurs in the education system to try and get you to think a certain way. If you're just exposed to these different opinions just a little bit more, it's much harder for that sort of psychological conditioning to take effect.
One final election update from Europe. The leading candidate in Romania was arrested. I believe he has now been released, but he was arrested for some kind of alleged interference or Russian interference in the election in Romania. But of course, we've been hearing about this for months. So we say, okay, maybe it's true. Maybe he's a Russian puppet. He's supported by the Russians. He loves Russia. But the people know it. It's not like it's a big scandal. It's not like there appears to be any actual laws broken here either. It just seems to be the case of the voters saying, okay, you've told us for months and months and months this guy's a Russian puppet, but we're still voting for him. He's still polling number one. And the governing officials and the European Union have basically said, well, okay, we're going to have to like arrest this guy because we can't let the Romanians vote for a pro-Russian candidate. Democracy is great, but you have to have kind of the right result for democracy to work.
Yeah, well, this guy, I think he won the first round, and then the EU canned it. They said, "Oh no, there's Russian interference. You've got to do it again." Well, I mean, Russia. We've seen this how this has played out in the U.S. election and how it's played out in many other elections. The excuse we even had a little bit here in New Zealand. Russian interference is used as an excuse when the population vote in a way that the people in charge don't like. And the reason I think they want to use Russian interference is because then they can mobilize a different sort of resources and laws for foreign interference than they can for your own people voting the way you don't like. I mean, you're not allowed to do anything about that, really. That's democracy, isn't it? But if you can implicate foreign interference into it, you can bring in your security intelligence services. You can bring in other resources. You can pass sort of different laws. It gives you more powers to do something about it. But I think this is really just an excuse to censor and interfere in democracy when the results aren't going the way that the powers that be would like them to.
Now, a few local points to wrap up this weekly roundup. An important development on the culture war side. Stephen Franks sent a letter, and he was asked to. I'm not exactly sure which group or client asked him to send this letter, but he did send a warning, essentially to people who are or these health services who are providing so-called gender affirming care, or just, child mutilators, as I prefer to call them, and basically saying, "Hey, if you're not providing up, if you're if the services that you are providing to these people are harmful, well, then you're going to get sued at some point. So we're putting you on notice. We're giving you a warning to say that the whatever the guidelines are, you're not following them properly, and you should be careful." And the government has been very slow, as we have seen, to update any of these guidelines, to follow any of the adjustments made in the United Kingdom, to basically say, okay, we're going to stop this so-called gender-affirming care for children. We're going to stop these puberty blockers that are sterilizing kids. We're going to stop these trans surgeries that are mutilating children. And in New Zealand, not much progress. And so this has caused a big uproar from the left, of course, but this seems to be an excellent development on our side to have people who have been willing to follow this up.
Yeah, and credit to Franks Ogilvie, to Stephen Franks, and to Inflection Point New Zealand, I believe, with the organisation that asked the letter to be
That's
sent.
right. I forgot the name, but Inflection Point New Zealand, and they had a conference recently. I think it was last year. We did cover it on the weekly roundup as well, where they had a number of like a very broad range of speakers as well, which is quite interesting for a group to have such a range of conservative to kind of old school leftists working together on this issue in New Zealand.
Yeah, I attended the conference. It was really good. It brought together a number of people who you would not always expect to be brought together and to agree. But I think what that illustrates is that everyone can kind of see that there's a real issue here with what is being done to children in the name of transgender healthcare or gender affirming care or whatever we want to call it. And the government has not done enough to stop this. They need to be doing more. Matt Ducey needs to be doing more. It's not acceptable to be harming children by doing this. And so, what Stephen Franks has explained that his letter does is he's sent the letter that the health services themselves should have sent to these healthcare providers reminding them that there are legal obligations in terms of the processes they follow and how they provide the care may change. And so they want to be very careful about the way they do things so as not to incur any legal liability. I think the government itself should have sent that letter. I think reminding people of their legal obligations is something you're allowed to do. It can have a sort of a different valence depending on who's receiving the information. It can depending on how you view that. You may view that as with a threatening valence, but I mean, it could actually be helpful. It could be if you take that advice, it might actually be preventing you from incurring serious legal costs in future. So, probably bears well for the people receiving those letters to just think carefully about it.
And on the economic point here in New Zealand, we have had a new policy announced this week around special economic zones. It's not confirmed, but it is up for discussion in the next few months by cabinet. And it seems like it being part of the coalition agreement and it being a big policy for New Zealand First and Shane Jones in particular, that there will be some kind of reopening of Marsden Point as a special economic zone. And these special economic zones have a long history. They've been used in many different countries last century. Most notably, as I did see this pointed out, and I thought it at least positive to mention, because after this was in China, after the terrible Great Leap Forward and Mao's destruction of China, his successor, Deng Xiaoping, ended up using these special economic zones to kind of bring China out of the darkness of communism successfully. So it's
Well, Hong Kong could have been especially
and
coming of that
also
kind of, wasn't it? Worked quite
but
well.
Hong Kong was managed by the British, right?
Yeah,
So
I know. It's just.
but it effectively functions the same. Hong Kong is a good modern day example perhaps of a part of China that has very special rules. And it seems like this is going to be something New Zealand will explore. And the ACT Party seems to like it as well. It is popular with some more libertarian types as well. I think Murray Rothbard ended up being, somewhat supportive of these by saying, "Hey, it's not ideal because these relaxed economic rules should apply to the entire country because they're good for everyone." But in the case lacking that, having these special areas where there may be lower regulations for a particular type of industry or lower taxes. In the case of Marsden Point, it'll be, hey, there will be lower taxes for foreign companies to come and invest in energy generation for New Zealand, and that creates a strong national security interest to have this energy generation happening right here in New Zealand, because any global crisis, as we have been talking about with geopolitics and China, we want to make sure that even if it's not the cheapest thing up front, that and we're not generating the most amount of tax out of it that we could be, it's is very, very important to New Zealand's national security.
Yeah, well, New Zealand is at the end of the world, really. We're the last stop on the line for the boats coming around with the fuel on. So if there's any sort of geopolitical funny business and the people get hesitant about driving the boats with the fuel out here, we're the first cab off the rank for them not to come to. So fuel security is very important. You need fuel to keep the economy going, keep people's everyday lives going, and it's important to have reserves and to be able to generate your own fuel as well. The special economic zones could allow more of the sort of development of our own fuel resource to make us more self-sufficient. So that would mitigate some of the risks of this geopolitical conflict. There is risks associated with it as well. We do screen overseas investment for a reason. And that's to make sure that the investment is in the national interests of the country, because there is such a thing as exploitative investment that helps the person doing the investing but doesn't help the country. And screening investments can screen out that type of stuff. So if you relax the rules, there's a risk that some more of that type of stuff might come through. So there's a risk of more sort of corrupt type stuff coming through. But I mean, overall, you can't have one thing without the other. So there's a trade-off there, and I think overall this could be a good thing. It could help generate more substantial investments into our energy.
And the final issue to cover on this week's show are some law and order changes made by the government. There's also been a reduction in violent crime that they have managed to achieve in the last year. And also, the key change that's being made is that citizens' arrests will now be made more legal. Essentially, they're currently, in the context of this is that retail crime is still quite high in New Zealand. In fact, I just mentioned the overall reduction in crime. Retail theft is actually still on the increase in New Zealand. And one of the problems is that as a private citizen or as a security guard or as a retail worker, if you see someone steal an item that's worth less than $1,000, you basically have no legal powers to go and restrain that person or to try and stop that theft from happening. And so the key reforms here are amending the Crimes Act so that any citizen can intervene at any time of the day. There are currently restrictions around whether it's daytime or nighttime. They're also going to make sure that you can actually restrain people when making a citizen's arrest and that it can be done in a reasonable way. And they're also going to change the defense of property provisions to make it clear that you can use reasonable force in the defense of property. So this is actually quite a good development, I believe, for self-defense and defense of your own property and defense of the property of others in New Zealand, and a good step in the right direction of more what would be in America called castle doctrine and so on, the kind of ability to stop criminals from taking your stuff and being at legal risk if you do try to stop them.
Yeah. Well, we live in an increasingly feminized society where people are very keen on only the authorized authorities using force. But unfortunately, the police aren't omnipresent. It takes time. The police have to be notified. It takes time to get to any place. And more often than not, the time it takes the police to get there is more than enough time for the person to get away. These sorts of rules enable the people who are there on the ground to more power to manage the situation themselves, detain the person, hold them, prevent them stealing the stuff until the police get there and can take them away. I think this is a good thing. I mean, I grew up in a rural area. There's no police around to help you if someone comes in, with a gun, is robbing your stuff, or even without a gun, stealing your stuff. There needs to be some sort of allowance for people to be able to manage these situations themselves. And I guess the risk is if people if the thieves know that the shopkeepers and stuff can do this, they might escalate the situation by arming themselves more or something like that. So I think that's a real risk, but I mean you have to balance that against the fact that there's probably not enough powers there at the moment for shopkeepers and stuff to do stuff about this if people are stealing their stuff.
That's the key thing, right? As a shopkeeper at the moment, you can obviously go and defend yourself. It's fine. You can defend your property, but it's like a gray zone where the police have, in fact, many cases where the police would say, "Oh, yeah, thank you for detaining this person, but actually, that was not legal for you to detain that person. You shouldn't do that." And there, it, you know, I don't know if there have been recent cases of people being charged for doing this, but removing that gray area, removing that area where someone who sees a crime and intervenes in a reasonable way is actually told, "Oh, you're breaking the law," when really it would be a reasonable situation where a normal person would say, "Oh, yes, it's fine to intervene. This obviously you want to be a good person, you want to intervene and you want to help," and then suddenly you find out that under the New Zealand law actually says that crime is okay. And there was an international issue, I remember, with California, right? I think they had a similar limit here to New Zealand. It's like $1,000. If somebody would steal $1,000 worth of stuff, then you wouldn't be able to stop them, and the police wouldn't prosecute them. Here in New Zealand, thankfully, we do. But what did they see in California? Obviously, crime went up, and that seems to be something that the National Party has identified as a big problem. So all the grief we've been giving Luxon, at least his ministers are doing a decent job here. In this case, it's Paul Goldsmith and Nicole McKee from the ACT Party who have taken this advice and are going to be implementing it. And that's a really great thing to see. I think it's a good positive thing to end today's show on, because we can complain a lot about the government and what they aren't doing properly. It's good to celebrate the small improvements that are made as well.
Yeah, I mean, I'm cheering for the government. I want them to do well. I want them to succeed. And I'm critical because I want them to do more of the things that would make a difference for ordinary people. And I want them to succeed at the next election because I think they're better than the other guys. But yeah, this is a good thing. It's a good policy. And I think they've done well on crime. Crime is slowly reducing. There was an upward trend in violent crime, and they've arrested that trend. So this is a positive development.
Well, thank you for listening and watching the show. Do remember you can still text on 2057. You can email inbox@realitycheck.radio, and we will read your feedback, and we really do appreciate it. Until next time, thank you, William.
Thanks, Stuart.